Eagles poke their heads out of crevices and wait for prey. The snapping shrimps with their trigger claws pop loudly. The lovely, colored world is glassed over. Hermit crabs, like frantic children, scamper on the bottom sand. And now one, finding an empty snail shell he likes better than his own, creeps out, exposing his soft body to the enemy for a moment, and then pops into the new shell. A wave breaks over the barrier and churns the glassy water for a moment and mixes bubbles into the pool, and then it clears and is tranquil and lovely and murderous again. Here a crab tears a leg from his brother. The anemones expand like soft and brilliant flowers, inviting any tired and perplexed animal to lie for a moment in their arms. And when some small crab or little tide pool Johnny accepts the green and purple invitation, the petals whip in, the stinging cells shoot tiny narcotic needles into the prey, and it grows weak and perhaps sleepy while the searing caustic digestive acids melt its body down. Then the creeping murderer, the octopus, steals out, slowly, softly, moving like a gray mist, pretending now to be a bit of weed, now a rock, now a lump of decaying meat, while its evil goat eyes watch coldly. It oozes and flows toward a feeding crab, and as it comes close, its yellow eyes burn, and its body turns rosy with the pulsing color of anticipation and rage. Then, suddenly, it runs lightly on the tips of its arms, as ferociously as a charging cat. It leaps savagely on the crab. There is a puff of black fluid, and the struggling mass is obscured in the sepia cloud while the octopus murders the crab. On the exposed rocks out of water, the barnacles bubble behind their closed doors, and the limpets dry out. And down to the rocks come the black flies to eat anything they can find. The sharp smell of iodine from the algae, and the lime smell of calcareous bodies, and the smell of powerful protein, smell of sperm and ova fill the air. On the exposed rocks, the starfish emit semen and eggs from between their rays. The smells of life and richness, of death and digestion, of decay and birth, burden the air. And salt spray blows in from the barrier where the ocean waits for its rising tide strength to permit it back into the great tide pool again. And on the reef, the whistling boy bellows like a sad and patient bull. In the pool, Doc and Hazel worked together. Hazel lived in the palace flophouse with Mac and the boys. Hazel got his name in as haphazard a way as his life was ever afterward. His worried mother had had 7 children in 8 years. Hazel was the 8th. And his mother became confused about his sex when he was born. She was tired and run down anyway from trying to feed and clothe 7 children and their father. She had tried every possible way of making money. Paper flowers, mushrooms at home, rabbits for meat and fur, while her husband from a canvas chair gave her every help his advice and reasoning and criticism could offer. She had a great aunt named Hazel, who was reputed to carry life insurance. The 8th child was named Hazel before the mother got it through her head that Hazel was a boy, and by that time she was used to the name and never bothered to change it. Hazel grew up, did 4 years in grammar school, 4 years in reform school, and didn't learn anything in either place. Reform schools are supposed to teach viciousness and criminality, but Hazel didn't pay enough attention. He came out of reform school as innocent of viciousness as he was of fractions and long division. Hazel loved to hear conversation, but he didn't listen to words, just to the tone of conversation. He asked questions, not to hear the answers, but simply to continue the flow. He was 26, dark-haired and pleasant, strong, willing, and loyal. Quite often he went collecting with Doc, and he was very good at it once he knew what was wanted. His fingers could creep like an octopus, could grab and hold like an anemone. He was sure-footed on the slippery rocks, and he loved the hunt. Doc wore his rain hat and high rubber boots as he worked, but Hazel sloshed about in tennis shoes and blue jeans. They were collecting starfish. Doc had an order for 300. Hazel picked a knobby, purplish starfish from the bottom of the pool and popped it into his nearly full gunny sack.
"I wonder what they do with them," he said.
"Do with what?" Doc asked.
"The starfish," said Hazel. "You sell them. You'll send out a barrel of them. What do the guys do with them? You can't eat them."
"They study them," said Doc patiently, and he remembered that he had answered this question for Hazel dozens of times before. But Doc had one mental habit he could not get over. When anyone asked a question, Doc thought he wanted to know the answer. That was the way with Doc. He never asked unless he wanted to know, and he could not conceive of the brain that would ask without wanting to know. But Hazel, who simply wanted to hear talk, had developed a system of making the answer to one question the basis of another. It kept conversation going.
"What do they find to study?" Hazel continued. "They're just starfish. There's millions of them around. I could get you a million of them."
"They're complicated and interesting animals," Doc said a little defensively. "Besides, these are going to the Middle West, to Northwestern University." Hazel used his trick.
"They got no starfish there?"
"They got no ocean there," said Doc.
"Oh,"
said Hazel, and he cast frantically about for a peg to hang a new question on. He hated to have a conversation die out like this. He wasn't quick enough. While he was looking for a question, Doc asked one. Hazel hated that. It meant casting about in his mind for an answer, and casting about in Hazel's mind was like wandering alone in a deserted museum. Hazel's mind was choked with uncatalogued exhibits. He never forgot anything, but he never bothered to arrange his memories. Everything was thrown together like fishing tackle in the bottom of a rowboat, hooks and sinkers and line and lures and gaffs all snarled up. Doc asked, "How are things going up at the palace?" Hazel ran his fingers through his dark hair, and he peered into the clutter of his mind.
"Pretty good," he said. "That fella Gay is moving in with us, I guess. His wife hits him pretty bad. He don't mind that when he's awake, but she waits till he gets to sleep and then hits him. He hates that. He has to wake up and beat her up, and then when he goes back to sleep, she hits him again. He don't get any rest, so he's moving in with us."
"That's a new one," said Doc. "She used to swear out a warrant and put him in jail."
"Yeah," said Hazel, "but that was before they built the new jail in Salinas. Used to be 30 days, and Gay was pretty hot to get out, but this new jail, radio in the tank and good bunks, and the sheriff's a nice fellow. Gay gets in there and he don't want to come out. He likes it so much his wife won't get him arrested anymore. So she figured out this hitting him while he's asleep. It's nerve-wracking, he says. And you know, as good as me, Gay never did take any pleasure beating her up. He only done it to keep his self-respect. But he gets tired of it. I guess he'll be with us now."
Doc straightened up. The waves were beginning to break over the barrier of the great tide pool. The tide was coming in, and little rivers from the sea had begun to flow over the rocks. The wind blew freshly in from the whistling buoy, and the barking of sea lions came from around the point. Doc pushed his rain hat on the back of his head. "We've got enough starfish," he said, and then went on.
"Look, Hazel, I know you've got 6 or 7 undersized abalones in the bottom of your sack. If we get stopped by a game warden, you're going to say they're mine, on my permit." aren't you?
Well, hell, said Hazel.
Look, Doc said kindly, suppose I get an order for abalones, and maybe the game warden thinks I'm using my collecting permit too often. Suppose he thinks I'm eating them.
Well, hell, said Hazel.
It's like the Industrial Alcohol Board. They've got suspicious minds. They always think I'm drinking the alcohol. They think that about everyone.
Well, ain't you?
Not much of it, said Doc. That stuff they put in it tastes terrible, and it's a big job to redistill it.
That stuff ain't so bad, said Hazel. Me and Mac had a snort of it the other day. What is it they put in?
Doc was about to answer when he saw it was Hazel's trick again.
Let's get moving, he said. He hoisted his sack of starfish on his shoulder, and he had forgotten the illegal abalones in the bottom of Hazel's sack. Hazel followed him up out of the tide pool and up the slippery trail to solid ground. The little crabs scampered and skittered out of their way. Hazel felt that he had better cement the grave over the topic of the abalones.
That painter guy came back to the palace, he offered.
Yes, said Doc.
Yeah. You see, he done all our pictures in chicken feathers, and now he says he got to do 'em all over again with nutshells. He says he changed his medium.
Doc chuckled. He's still building his boat?
Sure, said Hazel. He's got it all changed around. New kind of a boat. I guess he'll take it apart and change it.
Doc?
Is he nuts?
Doc swung his heavy sack of starfish to the ground and stood panting a little.
Nuts? He asked.
Oh, yes. I guess so. Nuts about the same amount we are. Only in a different way.
Such a thing had never occurred to Hazel. He looked upon himself as a crystal pool of clarity, and on his life as a troubled glass of misunderstood virtue. Doc's last statement had outraged him a little.
But that boat, he cried. He's been building that boat for 7 years that I know of. The blocks rotted out, and he made concrete blocks. Every time he gets it nearly finished, he changes it and starts over again. I think he's nuts. 7 years on a boat.
Doc was sitting on the ground, pulling off his rubber boots.
You don't understand, he said gently. Henri loves boats, but he's afraid of the ocean. What's he want a boat for, then? Hazel demanded.
He likes boats, said Doc.
But suppose he finishes his boat. Once it's finished, people will say, why don't you put it in the water? Then, if he puts it in the water, he'll have to go out in it, and he hates the water. So you see, he never finishes the boat, so he doesn't ever have to launch it.
Hazel had followed this reasoning to a certain point, but he abandoned it before it was resolved. Not only abandoned it, but searched for some way to change the subject.
I think he's nuts, he said lamely.
On the black earth on which the ice plants bloomed, hundreds of black stink bugs crawled, and many of them stuck their tails up in the air.
Look at all them stink bugs, Hazel remarked, grateful to the bugs for being there.
They're interesting, said Doc.
Well, what they got their asses up in the air for?
Doc rolled up his wool socks and put them in the rubber boots, and from his pocket he brought out dry socks and a pair of thin moccasins.
I don't know why, he said. I looked them up recently. They're very common animals, and one of the commonest things they do is put their tails up in the air. And in all the books there isn't one mention of the fact that they put their tails up in the air or why.
Hazel turned one of the stink bugs over with the toe of his wet tennis shoe, and the shining black beetle strove madly with floundering legs to get upright again.
Well, why do you think they do it?
I think they're praying, said Doc.
What?
Hazel was shocked.
The remarkable thing, said Doc, isn't that they put their tails up in the air. The really incredibly remarkable thing is that we find it remarkable. We can only use ourselves as yardsticks. If we did something as inexplicable and strange, we'd probably be praying. So maybe they're praying.
Let's get the hell out of here, said Hazel.
Chapter 7. The palace flophouse was no sudden development. Indeed, when Mac and Hazel and Eddie and Huey and Jones moved into it, they looked upon it as little more than shelter from the wind and the rain, as a place to go when everything else had closed, or when their welcome was thin and sere with overuse. Then the palace was only a long bare room, lit dimly by two small windows, walled with unpainted wood smelling strongly of fish meal. They had not loved it then, but Mac knew that some kind of organization was necessary, particularly among such a group of ravening individualists. A training army which has not been equipped with guns and artillery and tanks uses artificial guns and masquerading trucks to simulate its destructive panoply, and its toughening soldiers get used to field guns by handling logs on wheels. Mac, with a piece of chalk, drew five oblongs on the floor, each 7 feet long and 4 feet wide, and in each square he wrote a name. These were the simulated beds. Each man had property rights inviolable in his space. He could legally fight a man who encroached on his square. The rest of the room was property common to all. That was in the first days when Mac and the boys sat on the floor, played cards hunkered down, and slept on the hard boards. Perhaps, save for an accident of weather, they might always have lived that way. However, an unprecedented rainfall, which went on for over a month, changed all that. House-ridden, the boys grew tired of squatting on the floor. Their eyes became outraged by the bare board walls. Because it sheltered them, the house grew dear to them, and it had the charm of never knowing the entrance of an outraged landlord, for Lee Chong never came near it. Then, one afternoon, Huey came in with an army cot which had a torn canvas. He spent 2 hours sewing up the rip with fishing line, and that night the others, lying on the floor in their squares, watched Huey ooze gracefully into his cot. They heard him sigh with abysmal comfort, and he was asleep and snoring before anyone else. The next day, Mac puffed up the hill carrying a rusty set of springs he had found on a scrap iron dump. The apathy was broken then. The boys outdid one another in beautifying the palace flophouse until after a few months it was, if anything, over-furnished. There were old carpets on the floor, chairs with and without seats. Mac had a wicker chaise longue painted bright red. There were tables, a grandfather clock without dial face or works. The walls were whitewashed, which made it almost light and airy. Pictures began to appear, mostly calendars showing improbable luscious blondes holding bottles of Coca-Cola. Henri had contributed 2 pieces from his chicken feather period. A bundle of gilded cattails stood in one corner, and a sheaf of peacock feathers was nailed to the wall beside the grandfather clock. They were some time acquiring a stove, and when they did find what they wanted, a silver-scrolled monster with floriated warming ovens and a front like a nickel-plated tulip garden, they had trouble getting it. It was too big to steal, and its owner refused to part with it to the sick widow with 8 children whom Mac invented and patronized in the same moment. The owner wanted $1.50 and didn't come down to 80 cents for 3 days. The boys closed at 80 cents and gave him an IOU, which he probably still has. This transaction took place in Seaside, and the stove weighed 300 pounds. Mac and Huey exhausted every possibility of haulage for 10 days, and only when they realized that no one was going to take this stove home for them did they begin to carry it. It took them 3 days to carry it to Cannery Row, a distance of 5 miles, and they camped beside it at night. But once installed in the palace flophouse, it was the glory and the hearth and the center, its nickel flowers and foliage shone with a cheery light. It was the gold tooth of the palace. Fired up, it warmed the big room. Its oven was wonderful, and you could fry an egg on its shiny black lids. With the great stove came pride, and with pride the palace became home. Eddie planted morning glories to run over the door, and Hazel acquired some rather rare fuchsia bushes planted in 5-gallon cans, which made the entrance formal and a little cluttered. Mac and the boys loved the palace, and they even cleaned it a little sometimes. In their minds, they sneered at unsettled people who had no house to go to, and occasionally in their pride they brought a guest home for a day or two. Eddie was understudy bartender at La Ida. He filled in when Whitey, the regular bartender, was sick, which was as often as Whitey could get away with it. Every time Eddie filled in, a few bottles disappeared, so he couldn't fill in too often. But Whitey liked to have Eddie take his place because he was convinced, and correctly, that Eddie was one man who wouldn't try to keep his job permanently. Almost anyone could have trusted Eddie to this extent. Eddie didn't have to remove much liquor. He kept a gallon jug under the bar, and in the mouth of the jug there was a funnel. Anything left in the glasses, Eddie poured into the funnel before he washed the glasses. If an argument or a song were going on at La Ida, or late at night when good fellowship had reached its logical conclusion, Eddie poured glasses half or two-thirds full into the funnel. The resulting punch, which he took back to the palace, was always interesting, and sometimes surprising. The mixture of rye, beer, bourbon, scotch, wine, rum, and gin was fairly constant, but now and then some effete customer would order a stinger or an anisette or a curacao, and these little touches gave a distinct character to the punch. It was Eddie's habit always to shake a little Angostura into the jug just before he left. On a good night, Eddie got 3/4 of a gallon. It was a source of satisfaction to him that nobody was out anything. He had observed that a man got just as drunk on half a glass as on a whole one, that is, if he was in the mood to get drunk at all. Eddie was a very desirable inhabitant of the palace flophouse. The others never asked him to help with the house cleaning, and once Hazel washed 4 pairs of Eddie's socks. Now, on the afternoon when Hazel was out collecting with Doc in the great tide pool, the boys were sitting around in the palace sipping the result of Eddie's latest contribution. Gay was there, too, the latest member of the group. Eddie sipped speculatively from his glass and smacked his lips. "It's funny how you get a run," he said. "Take last night. There was at least 10 guys ordered Manhattans. Sometimes maybe you don't get 2 calls for a Manhattan in a month. It's the grenadine gives the stuff that taste." Mac tasted his, a big taste, and refilled his glass. "Yes," he said somberly, "it's little things make the difference." He looked about to see how this gem had set with the others. Only Gay got the full impact. "Sure is," he said. "Does." "Where's Hazel today?" Mac asked. Jones said, "Hazel went out with Doc to get some starfish." Mac nodded his head soberly. "That Doc is a hell of a nice fella," he said. "He'll give you a quarter any time. When I cut myself, he put on a new bandage every day. A hell of a nice fella. The others nodded in profound agreement. I've been wondering for a long time, Mac continued, what we could do for him. Something nice. Something he'd like.
He'd like a dame, said Huey.
He's got 3-4 dames, said Jones. You can always tell when he pulls them front curtains closed and when he plays that kind of church music on the phonograph. Max said reprovingly to Huey, just because he doesn't run no dame naked through the streets in the daytime, you think Doc celebrate.
What celebrate? Eddie asked.
That's when you can't get no dame, said Mac.
I thought it was a kind of party, said Jones.
A silence fell on the room. Mac shifted in his chaise longue. Huey let the front legs of his chair down on the floor. They looked into space, and then they all looked at Mac. Mac said, "Hum."
Eddie said, "What kind of party you think Doc'd like?"
"What other kind is there?" said Jones. Mac mused. "Doc wouldn't like this stuff from the whinin' jug."
"How do you know?" Huey demanded. "You never offered him none."
"Oh, I know," said Mac. "He's been to college. Once I seen a dame in a fur coat go in there. Never did see her come out. It was 2 o'clock the last I looked. And that church music going? Nah, you couldn't offer him none of this." He filled his glass again.
"This tastes pretty nice after the third glass," Huey said loyally.
"No," said Mac, "not for Doc. Have to be whiskey. The real thing."
"He likes beer," said Jones. "He's all the time going over to Lee's for beer, sometimes in the middle of the night."
Mac said, "I figure when you buy beer, you're buying too much tare. Take 8% beer. Why, you're spending your dough for 92% water and color and hops, stuff like that. Eddie," he added, "you think you could get 4 or 5 bottles of whiskey at La Ida next time Whitey's sick?"
"Sure," said Eddie. "Sure, I could get it, but that'd be the end. No more golden eggs. I think Johnny's suspicious anyways. Other day he says, 'I smell a mouse named Eddie.' I was gonna lay low and only bring the jug for a while."
"Yeah," said Jones. "Don't you lose that job. If something happened to Whitey, you could fall right in there for a week or so till they got somebody else. I guess if we're going to give a party for Doc, we gotta buy the whiskey. How much is whiskey a gallon?"
"I don't know," said Huey. "I never get more than 1/2 pint at a time myself. At one time, that is. I figure you get a quart and right away you got friends. But you get 1/2 pint, and you can drink it in the lot before, well, before you got a lot of folks around."
"It's gonna take dough to give Doc a party," said Mac. "If we're going to give him a party at all, it ought to be a good one. Should have a big cake. I wonder when is his birthday?"
"Don't need a birthday for a party," said Jones.
"No, but it's nice," said Mac. "I figure it'd take 10 or 12 bucks to give Doc a party you wouldn't be ashamed of."
They looked at one another speculatively. Huey suggested, "The Hediondo Cannery is hiring guys."
"No," said Mac quickly. "We got good reputations, and we don't want to spoil 'em. Every one of us keeps a job for a month or more when we take one. That's why we can always get a job when we need one. Suppose we take a job for a day or two, why, we'll lose our reputation for sticking. Then if we needed a job, there wouldn't nobody have us."
The rest nodded quick agreement. "I figure I'm going to work a couple of months, November and part of December," said Jones. "Makes it nice to have money around Christmas. We could cook a turkey this year."
"By God, we could," said Mac. "I know a place up Carmel Valley where there's 1,501 flock."
"Valley," said Huey. "You know, I used to collect stuff up the valley for Doc. Turtles and crayfish and frogs. Got a nickel apiece for frogs.
Me too, said Gay. I got 500 frogs one time. If Doc needs frogs, it's a setup, said Mac. We could go up the Carmel River and have a little outing, and we wouldn't tell Doc what it was for, and then we'd give him one hell of a party. A quiet excitement grew in the palace flophouse. Gay, said Mac, take a look out the door and see if Doc's car is in front of his place. Gay set down his glass and looked out. Not yet, he said. Well, he ought to be back any minute, said Mac. Now, here's how we'll go about it.
Chapter 8. In April 1932, the boiler at the Hediondo cannery blew a tube for the third time in 2 weeks, and the board of directors, consisting of Mr. Randolph and a stenographer, decided that it would be cheaper to buy a new boiler than to have to shut down so often. In time, the new boiler arrived, and the old one was moved into the vacant lot between Lee Chong's and the Bear Flag restaurant, where it was set on blocks to await an inspiration on Mr. Randolph's part on how to make some money out of it. Gradually, the plant engineer removed the tubing to use to patch other outworn equipment at the Hediondo. The boiler looked like an old-fashioned locomotive without wheels. It had a big door in the center of its nose and a low fire door. Gradually, it became red and soft with rust, and gradually the mallow weeds grew up around it, and the flaking rust fed the weeds. Flowering myrtle crept up its sides, and the wild anise perfumed the air about it. Then someone threw out a datura root, and the thick, fleshy tree grew up, and the great white bells hung down over the boiler door, and at night the flowers smelled of love and excitement, an incredibly sweet and moving odor. In 1935, Mr. and Mrs. Sam Malloy moved into the boiler. The tubing was all gone now, and it was a roomy, dry, and safe apartment. True, if you came in through the fire door, you had to get down on your hands and knees, but once in, there was headroom in the middle, and you couldn't want a drier, warmer place to stay. They shagged a mattress through the fire door and settled down. Mr. Malloy was happy and contented there, and for quite a long time so was Mrs. Malloy. Below the boiler on the hill, there were numbers of large pipes also abandoned by the Hediondo. Toward the end of 1937, there was a great catch of fish, and the canneries were working full-time, and a housing shortage occurred. Then it was that Mr. Malloy took to renting the larger pipes as sleeping quarters for single men, at a very nominal fee. With a piece of tar paper over one end and a square of carpet over the other, they made comfortable bedrooms, although men used to sleeping curled up had to change their habits or move out. There were those, too, who claimed that their snores echoing back from the pipes woke them up, but on the whole, Mr. Malloy did a steady small business and was happy. Mrs. Malloy had been contented until her husband became a landlord, and then she began to change. First it was a rug, then a wash tub, then a lamp with a colored silk shade. Finally, she came into the boiler on her hands and knees one day, and she stood up and said a little breathlessly, "Holman's are having a sale of curtains, real lace curtains, and edges of pink and blue, $1.98 a set with curtain rods thrown in." Mr. Malloy sat up on the mattress. "Curtains?" he demanded. "What in God's name do you want curtains for?"
"I like things nice," said Mrs. Malloy. "I always did like to have things nice for you." And her lower lip began to tremble.
"But, darling," Sam Malloy cried, "I got nothing against curtains. I like curtains."
"Only $1.98, Mrs. Malloy quavered. "And you begrudge me $1.98?
And she sniffled, and her chest heaved. I don't begrudge you, said Mr. Molloy, but, darling, for Christ's sake, what are we going to do with curtains? We got no windows.
Mrs. Molloy cried and cried, and Sam held her in his arms and comforted her. Men just don't understand how a woman feels, she sobbed. Men just never try to put themselves in a woman's place. And Sam lay beside her and rubbed her back for a long time before she went to sleep.
Chapter 9. When Doc's car came back to the laboratory, Mac and the boys secretly watched Hazel help to carry in the sacks of starfish. In a few minutes, Hazel came damply up the chicken walk to the palace. His jeans were wet with seawater to the thighs, and where it was drying, the white salt rings were forming. He sat heavily in the patent rocker that was his and shucked off his wet tennis shoes. Mac asked, "How's Doc feeling?" "Fine," said Hazel. "You can't understand a word he says. Know what he said about stink bugs? No, I better not tell you." "He seem in a nice friendly mood?" Mac asked. "Sure," said Hazel. "We got 200-300 starfish. He's all right." "I wonder if we better all go over," Mac asked himself, and he answered himself, "No, I guess it would be better if one went alone. It might get him mixed up if we all went." "What is this?" Hazel asked. "We got plans," said Mac. "I'll go myself so as not to startle him. You guys stay here and wait. I'll come back in a few minutes." Mac went out, and he teetered down the chicken walk and across the track. Mr. Molloy was sitting on a brick in front of his boiler. "How are you, Sam?" Mac asked. "Pretty good. How's the missus?" "Pretty good," said Mr. Molloy. "You know any kind of glue you can stick cloth to iron?" Ordinarily, Mac would have thrown himself headlong into this problem, but now he was not to be deflected. "No," he said. He went across the vacant lot, crossed the street, and entered the basement of the laboratory. Doc had his hat off now, since there was practically no chance of getting his head wet unless a pipe broke. He was busy removing the starfish from the wet sacks and arranging them on the cool concrete floor. The starfish were twisted and knotted up, for a starfish loves to hang on to something, and for an hour these had found only each other. Doc arranged them in long lines, and very slowly they straightened out until they lay in symmetrical stars on the concrete floor. Doc's pointed brown beard was damp with perspiration as he worked. He looked up a little nervously as Mac entered. It was not that trouble always came in with Mac, but something always entered with him. "Hiya, Doc," said Mac. "All right," said Doc uneasily. "Hear about Phyllis May over at the Bear Flag? She hit a drunk and got his tooth in her fist, and it's infected clear to the elbow. She showed me the tooth. It was out of a plate. Is a false tooth poison, Doc?" "I guess everything that comes out of a human mouth is poison," said Doc, warningfully. "Has she got a doctor?" "The bouncer fixed her up," said Mac. "I'll take her some sulfa," said Doc, and he waited for the storm to break. He knew Mac had come for something, and Mac knew he knew it. Mac said, "Doc, you got any need for any kind of animals now?" Doc sighed with relief. "Why?" he asked guardedly. Mac became open and confidential. "I'll tell you, Doc. I and the boys got to get some dough. We simply got to. It's for a good purpose. You might say a worthy cause." "Phyllis May's arm?" Mac saw the chance, weighed it, and gave it up. "Well, no," he said. "It's more important than that. You can't kill a whore. No, this is different. I and the boys thought if you needed something, why, we'd get it for you, and that way we could make a little piece of change. It seemed simple and innocent. Doc laid down 4 more starfish in lines. I could use 300 or 400 frogs, he said. I'd get them myself, but I've got to go down to La Jolla tonight. There's a good tide tomorrow, and I have to get some octopi.
Same price for frogs? Mac asked. 5 cents apiece?
Same price, said Doc. Mac was jovial.
Don't you worry about frogs, Doc, he said. We'll get you all the frogs you want. You just rest easy about frogs. Why, we can get 'em right up Carmel River. I know a place.
Good, said Doc. I'll take all you get, but I need about 300.
Just you rest easy, Doc. Don't you lose no sleep about it. You'll get your frogs, maybe 700, 800.
He put the Doc at his ease about frogs, and then a little cloud crossed Mac's face.
Doc, he said, any chance of using your car to go up the valley?
No, said Doc. I told you, I have to drive to La Jolla tonight to make tomorrow's tide.
Oh, said Mac dispiritedly. Oh, well,
don't you worry about it, Doc. Maybe we can get Lee Chong's old truck. And then his face fell a little further.
Doc, he said, on a business deal like this, would you advance 2 or 3 bucks for gasoline? I know Lee Chong won't give us gas.
No, said Doc. He had fallen into this before. Once he had financed Gay to go for turtles. He financed him for 2 weeks, and at the end of that time Gay was in jail on his wife's charge, and he never did go for turtles.
Well, maybe we can't go then, said Mac sadly.
Now, Doc really needed the frogs. He tried to work out some method which was business and not philanthropy.
I'll tell you what I'll do, he said. I'll give you a note to my gas station so you can get 10 gallons of gas. How'll that be?
Mac smiled.
Fine, he said. That'll work out just fine. I and the boys will get an early start tomorrow. Time you get back from the south, we'll have more damn frogs than you ever seen in your life.
Doc went to the labeling desk and wrote a note to Red Williams at the gas station, authorizing the issue of 10 gallons of gasoline to Mac.
Here you are, he said.
Mac was smiling broadly.
Doc, he said, you can get to sleep tonight and not even give frogs a thought. We'll have piss pots full of them by the time you get back.
Doc watched him go a little uneasily. Doc's dealings with Mac and the boys had always been interesting, but rarely had they been profitable to Doc. He remembered ruefully the time Mac sold him 15 Tomcats, and by night the owners came and got every one.
Mac, he had asked, why all Tomcats?
Mac said, Doc, it's my own invention, but I'll tell you because you're a good friend. You make a big wire trap, and then you don't use bait. You see, well, you use a lady cat. Catch every goddamn tomcat in the country that way.
From the laboratory, Mac crossed the street and went through the swinging screen doors into Lee Chong's grocery. Mrs. Lee was cutting bacon on the big butcher's block. A Lee cousin primped up slightly wilted heads of lettuce the way a girl primps a loose finger wave. A cat lay asleep on a big pile of oranges. Lee Chong stood in his usual place back of the cigar counter and in front of the liquor shelves. His tapping finger on the change mat speeded up a little when Mac came in. Mac wasted no time in sparring.
Lee, he said, Doc over there's got a problem. He's got a big order for frogs from the New York Museum. Means a lot to Doc. Besides the dough, there's a lot of credit getting an order like that. Doc's got to go south, and I and the boys said we'd help him out. I think a guy's friends ought to help him out of a hole when they can, especially a nice guy like Doc. Why, I bet he spends $60-$70 a month with you.
Lee Chong remained silent and watchful. His fat finger barely moved on the change mat, but it flicked slightly like a tense cat's tail. Mac plunged into his thesis.
Will you let us take your old truck to go up Carmel Valley for frogs for Doc? For good old Doc?
Lee Chong smiled in triumph.
Truck no good, he said. Broke down.
This staggered Mac for a moment, but he recovered. He spread the order for gasoline on the cigar counter.
Look, he said, Doc needs them frogs. He give me this order for gas to get them. I can't let Doc down. Now, Gay is a good mechanic. If he fixes your truck and puts it in good shape, will you let us take it?
Lee put back his head so that he could see Mac through his half glasses. There didn't seem to be anything wrong with the proposition. The truck really wouldn't run. Gay really was a good mechanic, and the order for gasoline was definite evidence of good faith.
How long you be gone? Lee asked.
Maybe half a day, maybe a whole day, just till we get the frogs. Lee was worried, but he couldn't see any way out. The dangers were all there, and Lee knew all of them.
Okay, said Lee. Good, said Mac. I knew Doc could depend on you. I'll get Gay right to work on that truck.
He turned about to leave.
By the way, he said, Doc's paying us 5 cents apiece for those frogs. We're going to get 700 or 800. How about taking a pint of old tennis shoes just till we can get back with the frogs?
No, said Lee Chong.
Chapter 10. Frankie began coming to Western Biological when he was 11 years old. For a week or so, he just stood outside the basement door and looked in. Then one day he stood inside the door. 10 days later, he was in the basement. He had very large eyes, and his hair was a dark, wiry, dirty shock. His hands were filthy. He picked up a piece of Excelsior and put it in a garbage can, and then he looked at Doc where he worked labeling specimen bottles containing purple vilella. Finally, Frankie got to the workbench, and he put his dirty fingers on the bench. It took Frankie 3 weeks to get that far, and he was ready to bolt every instant of the time. Finally, one day, Doc spoke to him.
What's your name, son?
Frankie.
Where do you live?
Up there,
a gesture up the hill.
Why aren't you in school?
I don't go to school.
Why not?
They don't want me there.
Your hands are dirty. Don't you ever wash?
Frankie looked stricken, and then he went to the sink and scrubbed his hands, and always afterward he scrubbed his hands almost raw every day. And he came to the laboratory every day. It was an association without much talk. Doc, by a telephone call, established that what Frankie said was true. They didn't want him in school. He couldn't learn, and there was something a little wrong with his coordination. There was no place for him. He wasn't an idiot. He wasn't dangerous. His parents, or parent, would not pay for his keep in an institution. Frankie didn't often sleep at the laboratory, but he spent his days there. And sometimes he crawled in the Excelsior crate and slept. That was probably when there was a crisis at home. Doc asked, "Why do you come here?"
"You don't hit me or give me a nickel," said Frankie.
"Do they hit you at home?"
"There's uncles around all the time at home. Some of them hit me and tell me to get out, and some of them give me a nickel and tell me to get out."
Where is your father?
Dead, said Frankie vaguely.
Where's your mother?
With the uncles.
Doc clipped Frankie's hair and got rid of the lice. At Lee Chong's, he got him a new pair of overalls and a striped sweater, and Frankie became his slave.
I love you,
he said one afternoon.
Oh, I love you.
He wanted to work in the laboratory. He swept out every day, but there was something a little wrong. He couldn't get a floor quite clean. He tried to help with grating crayfish for size. There they were in a bucket, all sizes. They were to be grouped in the big pans, laid out, all the 3-inch ones together and all the 4-inch ones, and so forth. Frankie tried, and the perspiration stood on his forehead, but he couldn't do it. Size relationships just didn't get through to him.
No, Doc would say. Look, Frankie, put them beside your finger like this, so you'll know which ones are this long. See? This one goes from the tip of your finger to the base of your thumb. Now you'd just pick out another one that goes from the tip of your finger down to the same place, and it'll be right.